Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
The views expressed by today's guest do not necessarily reflect those of North State Public Radio. My guest today was a paramedic in some of California's busiest 911 systems and currently trains paramedics. Sarah K. Grace spent years studying both physical and energy anatomy and now uses her skills as a medical intuitive, clairvoyant medium, and energy healer to help clients in private practice. She has written a memoir, Journey into Grace, Tales of a Psychic Paramedic. Sarah Grace, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here, Nancy.
Now, your last name is Grace, and the title of your book is Journey into Grace. That sounds like a very convenient last name.
It is a very convenient last name, and it is my birth last name.
So. It was the name you were born with.
It is indeed. Yes, very fitting.
Well, it's kind of funny that you are a psychic yourself, because you didn't always think that psychics, you didn't have a very good opinion of psychics.
I did not. It was a long coming to terms with my energetic abilities for me. Essentially, I was raised in a very small town in South Dakota and beautiful area. It was very conservative, pre-internet. And so there was not a lot of access to the outside world. And one day I woke up and I could just see aura colors and kind of sense feelings and thoughts and different, you know, vibrations.
How old were you then?
Seven years old. Yeah, 7 years old. And I was a kid, so I was like, oh, this is how it is for everyone. So I just started talking about it. And very quickly, I was told by my family, no, actually, don't talk about that. And really, you know, kind of put a lot of fear into me about it being wrong.
They let you know that was strange and you shouldn't be talking about that.
Definitely. So I ran around for 25 years thinking that there was something really wrong with me, and I developed a lot of toxic shame out of that. And then it wasn't until I finally became a paramedic after rolling through a lot of different life experiences that the energies just started to work through me on 911 calls. And so I was there to essentially be able to assist in the facilitation of the soul transition into death. And
but before that, though, you didn't think psychics were... you had a negative stereotype of psychics.
Definitely.
You write that in your book.
I did. Yeah. So because I was kind of shamed and condemned for it, and I ran around with that toxic shame for a long time, I didn't want to come to terms or come out with my abilities, so to speak. I didn't want to be shunned, or, you know, I feared being outcast, or, you know, thinking that something was mentally wrong with me. And so I kind of kept it buried deep inside for a long time. And once I started utilizing it is when I finally decided to challenge everything that I'd been taught about it, which was obviously a big undertaking for me. But even in the process of opening finally to it after such a long period of time, I looked at like the psychic genre or the psychic community with a real like kind of skeptical viewpoint. I thought that a lot of them, to me, seemed really ungrounded and didn't seem to make a lot of sense with some of the words that they were using and how it applies in the everyday reality. So I had to overcome my own
prejudices.
Yes.
In fact, here's what you wrote in your book. I'd always been too ashamed to find out more because the typical examples of psychics I had painted in my head were that of middle-aged women with bad hair dye who wore flowy clothes and spangly jewelry and used New Age jargon and a bunch of words that really made no practical sense. Indigo what? Star seed and crystalline ascension? Huh? To me, it wasn't hard to see why psychics weren't taken seriously by the mainstream. Mm-hmm. Much of what they said didn't seem to have any application in the real world. So you said you were you realized how judgmental you were, but you made a deal with yourself that if you were going to be open to working with energy, and you finally decided, yeah, you were, it had to be my way.
Right.
So you weren't going to be that lady with the bad hair dye and the flowy clothes
and
the jargon. That wasn't your style.
Not my style.
You said, I had to be able to make sense of the information, and I wanted it to be grounded, practical, and applicable in everyday life. I figured that if I couldn't utilize the information to help others in their day-to-day existence, then what was the point? So you said you even wrote out a list of questions, a list of questions that you had a lot to learn. Mm-hmm. You wanted to learn what was psychic ability?
Mm-hmm.
Why could I see the way I did? I could hear, feel, know. Why did I see spirits?
Mm-hmm.
Why did I know things that were going to happen before they did?
Mm-hmm.
Why could I leave my body and visit other people in places enough to call them to tell them what color shirt they were wearing?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know. So I fell back on my strength and fierce discipline by applying my paramedic mindset to a self-imposed study curriculum.
Yes.
So you say you embarked on a year-long energy internship.
Yes.
So you didn't go into this with the idea that you were going to be that airy-fairy kind of psychic.
No.
That you wanted to be able to use these abilities to help people.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
But you didn't start out as a young woman saying, okay, I'm going to be a paramedic.
No, it took
the route was very a long one before you got to that point.
Correct.
And you, in your first chapter in your book, you call it Dakota Duality.
Mm-hmm.
And why did you call it? Because you mentioned that's where you were born, that's where you grew up.
Mm-hmm.
But why duality?
Well, duality in the aspect that there are, you know, duality is light and dark. And so there were positive aspects of my upbringing and attributes to the family that I had and the experience that I had there. It is a beautiful place and not far, actually, from what's happening with the pipeline stuff right now. It's right across the river from that, which is very interesting. But there was also a lot of darkness for me just in terms of family chaos and real rigid belief structures, not a lot of openness to outside perspectives and things like that. Plus, like as I said before, the disconnect at the time with, you know, before pre-internet, no, you know, cell phone, no any of that type of thing. So it was a very isolated experience for me. And I really had a lot of fear around the fact that I seemed to be the only one who was perceiving energies like this and really took it to heart.
Well, let me remind people that my guest is Sarah Grace. The title of her memoir is Journey into Grace, Tales of a Psychic Paramedic. And when you were growing up, your mother, you're talking about fear. I mean, you must have been afraid of your mother. It was really hard reading that chapter, Sarah,
yes,
about what your mother would do to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's just hard to believe a mother could do that to her child.
It was definitely an intense upbringing.
And so that's why when I just first open your book and before I read what your mother was like, I see that you dedicated your book to your mother.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, this book is dedicated to my mother, the beautiful, powerful soul whose lessons helped me to become who I am today.
Indeed.
That was a very generous thing for you to write, Sarah.
Well, it took a lot for me to write that, actually, and there's a specific reason behind that, because I personally believe that our greatest teachers are those who give us the most challenging lessons. And as a result of the upbringing that I had, I really, through violence and chaos and isolation and fear, had to face a lot of aspects of myself and kind of learn my own power and find my own voice, if you will. And so essentially, that's why I dedicated the book to her, because I'm grateful to this day. The reason that I was able to ultimately become a paramedic and work in the 911 systems of Compton, Inglewood, and South Central LA, which is a very obviously intense, dark frequency, was because, and that's just one example of the different places that I've worked and things that I've done, but the intensity I learned as a result of her.
My guest is Sarah Grace, and her memoir is Journey into Grace. And you said when you were growing up, you could see things like you'd look out across the field and see trees communicating with each other.
Yes. Well, the easiest way for me that I've found that people can really understand kind of my perspective is, you know, everybody's gone into a Target or a Best Buy. And so you go into the back of the store and there's the wall of television screens on the back. And you know how they're normally playing like the same thing. Mm-hmm. Well, imagine that every one of those screens was playing something different that was flashing different colors and different, you know, information. And the center screen is what you had to focus on because mm-hmm. the center screen, if you will, is this reality.
That all the rest of the people around you see.
Correct. And so the other flashing information is just the higher sense perception, if you will. And it kind of competes for the attention. And when I was young and I didn't understand what it was and I didn't understand how to ground and to work with my own energy field, I would get lost in that and be quite spacey and disconnected and have, you know, difficulties with it. But
well, you mentioned, too, when you were young, that this Native American Indian chief mm-hmm. came to you when you were saying, I just don't know what to do. And he says, be patient, dear girl, for one day you will.
Mm-hmm. That one day is now.
But it was a long time before you saw him again. You said you didn't see him again for decades.
Correct, decades.
So he was, would you call him a spirit guide? What would you call him?
Likely a spirit guide. You know, just, yeah.
Because the Dakotas were where... we still think it relate that area to the Indian culture,
right.
Native
Sioux,
American
yep,
culture.
Sioux and Lakota, specifically in the areas that I was raised in, yes.
So it must have been maybe comforting that this Native American spirit says, be patient, dear girl.
Very,
you will eventually understand.
Yes, very comforting. And the power and magnitude of that particular episode really helped to transform and kind of give me a little bit of hope because I was... At the point that we're talking about in my life, I was still very young and I was still in a space feeling very, very lost and very isolated. So to have this connectedness with this spirit, this guide, if you will, it kind of gave me a little bit of extra courage perhaps or energy to continue to move forward.
Well, there was another entity that you mentioned in your book.
Mm-hmm.
And at one particular point, for example, I guess you might call her, would come and comfort you. For example, your mother would be smothering you with a pillow.
Mm-hmm.
And what would you see?
Well, a few particular times it was that of a celestial. So the energy frequency of the angelic or celestial realm. And there was one in particular. And the way that I've come to understand, just to give a brief synopsis of what like angels or entities or, you know, guides or totems or any of that is it's all a different vibrational resonance. It's a tone or a pitch that kind of comes in to assist or to facilitate through message or through, you know, however the interpretation. But in the instance with what you're mentioning pertaining to my mom, yes, I had an angel come in and essentially she told me to play dead because what was happening repeatedly is at nighttime and I never knew when exactly it would happen. My mom would come in and she would just put a pillow over my face and start to smother me. And sometimes it was just brief, kind of like a tease almost. And then sometimes, you know, there was one or two instances in particular where she held it there. To the point that, you know, she thought that perhaps I had died because she poked my body. And that's when you're referencing the celestial came in and the angel told me to play dead, just stop and play dead, which is what I did. And then my mom stopped with the smothering and poked my body and left the room. And so she was very surprised when I came down for cereal the next morning. But the way that I'm looking at it now, it's like we all have connectedness to our own intuitive capacity, that gut sense or the gut feeling of knowing things. And this is just kind of an amped up version of that, if you will, because I have the capacity to see the energy. So I could see the angel.
And you describe her as being over 12 feet tall.
They tend to be tall, indeed.
And yet you weren't frightened.
No, the celestial.
You were comforted by
yeah, the celestial and angelic realms come with a very high-pitched vibrational resonance, which is very soothing, very soothing, very calming.
Well, you also say here was this bright, high vibrational entity that you saw. But then when you describe right after that, this darkness,
mm-hmm.
you say Enter the Darkness, Demons, Dragons, Gargoyles. Mm-hmm. And the Spanish painter, Francisco de Goya, painted a picture of a guy with his head on the table surrounded by these dark figures, just like what you described. And mm-hmm. so when I read your description in your book, yeah. I thought, my gosh, that must have been something that Goya actually experienced mm-hmm. rather than from his I always assumed it was from his imagination. Mm-hmm. And in the written on this table where the guy's put his head down, the sleep of reason produces monsters. And so when I read your description, I thought, yeah, that's just like what Goya, maybe he actually experienced these monsters. Mm-hmm. Because that's what you described, just like right. his painting.
Right. Well, and even if you can't see them in particular, a lot of times you can just feel. So it's the darker or more dense energy frequencies. And again, the way that I, now that I've become educated and have an understanding about energy and kind of what it all is and how it works, for the dualistic paradigm that we're currently living in, we need both the light and the dark so that we can have the perceived sense of separation, right? So we can have our little human life experience. And so in order to have the super high-pitched, you know, celestial realms and above, there have to be an offset, naturally, of the polarity of that, the paradox or the duality of that. And so now I understand, at the time, of course, when I'm 10 and I'm in bed in South Dakota and I'm seeing these things I didn't understand, I was utterly terrified. And so for listeners who are perhaps seeing visions, I think really what it's important to know is like, it's not that there's actually an apparition necessarily standing there, a gargoyle or a demon. What it is it's an energetic vibration usually attracted by the subconscious patterning and other things that we could talk about in depth at another time, pertaining to what's going on with the individual. And so just learning about the vibrational resonance and having an understanding that you're safe, right? And there's a reason that it's there, and really not to fear it, not to give your power over to it, but just to maintain your sense of self and then move forward.
My guest is Sarah K. Grace. She has written a memoir, Journey into Grace, Tales of a Psychic Paramedic. We were just talking about the fact that your mother did things that would just seem horrifying, that a mother would do that to her mm-hmm. child. But then you lost your mother.
I did.
And that is adds to the sadness of your story when you're before your senior year in high school, mm-hmm. your mother gets diagnosed with cancer. Mm-hmm. And some people, if they get a diagnosis like that, they want to change. If they've been smoking, they want to quit smoking, or they want to change their lifestyle. How did your mother react to the diagnosis of cancer?
By that point, she was, and just for full, like kind of to paint the picture fully for the listeners, my mother was a beautiful woman, and she was also like quite challenged, I guess we could say, whether it's mentally or emotionally. And so there was some sort of, you know, Jekyll and Hyde aspect to her where she sometimes would be a great mother and sometimes would just kind of snap and go into a really violent state or rage. And for the latter part of my youth, it was more in that tendency. So the violence, I never knew necessarily when it would come, and it was quite extreme in addition to the pillow smothering, that type of thing. And I never understood why. You know, of course, I was a kid and I just wanted my mother to love me. And so when I was, I was working with that in my everyday experience, plus then seeing and feeling energies on top of and not being able to say anything about it. So I was really in a state of chaos and tremendous fear. And then she got sick, and she was, you know, pretty depressed.
She went through chemotherapy.
She went through chemo, she'd pretty much quit on life by that point. And so it took her pretty fast, roughly within 6 months. And ultimately, when she died, I just felt a tremendous loss or sadness because, again, there was no hope or chance then for us to ever rectify and have a mother-daughter, a healthy mother-daughter relationship.
I thought it was interesting, too, that when she did her final moments, you were hoping, you were a senior in high school, mm-hmm. you were hoping your mother could come to your graduation celebration. Mm-hmm. She made it, but then it was later that day of your graduation that she collapsed.
Yeah, at my graduation party. Yeah. That's when she collapsed, and she had a seizure. And so that was the last time I ever saw her conscious, was at the graduation party. And that was really the straw that broke the camel's back for me personally, because up until that point, I had felt overstimulated, number one, you know, isolated and really frightened by the visions and the energies I was perceiving. And then to have the death of my mom on top of it, then I personally took that and spun out and went into a cascade reaction that lasted the next several years.
In fact, the title of your second chapter is The Descent.
Yes.
And boy, I mean,
off the rails. Yes.
It was even shocking the depths that you descended to, Sarah.
Yes, I went
for
it. I
mean, here's this sweet young thing growing up in the Midwest, and you decide, so your mother dies as you are just finishing high school.
Mm-hmm.
And why did you decide, or where did you decide to go to college, and why did you pick that college?
Well, I was a runner, so at the age of 13, I started running outside, and that was kind of my first sense of meditative, like, or meditation and or safety. And through the rhythmic pounding of my feet on the ground and my breath going in and out, I felt like I could actually be in my body.
I think that may be somewhat typical. People may not realize it, but I know of somebody else that had that same experience and mm-hmm. tried meditation and got nowhere until she started running.
Yeah.
And then, that just like you're saying, that rhythmic running and the rhythm of your feet.
Mm-hmm.
So you took to running.
I did, and I loved it. So I would spend hours and hours, and that was my way to escape my early life. And then I got a running scholarship to Morehead State University, which is now Minnesota State at Morehead. And it's desolate. It's Fargo. Like, if you've seen the movie Fargo, that's where I went to college. Fargo, Morehead are twin cities, like Minneapolis, St. Paul are twin cities.
But you are a desirable candidate because for a scholarship, because of your running ability, but also academically you excelled.
Yes. Well, because I was just trying to fit in, and I was in overdrive all throughout my high school and junior high and high school experience. On the outside, I would have looked like I was thriving. You know, I was very mm-hmm. popular and, you know, student council president, excuse me, like those types of things, and high GPA and, you know, state ranked runner. Like, I had it together, but what I was doing was compensating out of fear. I was really compensating. And yes, there was a lot of violence at home, but out of the two, I mean, that was almost paled in comparison to having this fear that I was mentally ill or mentally unstable due to the energies that I was seeing. So that was my way to cope.
My guest is Sarah Grace, and she has written a memoir, Journey into Grace, Tales of a Psychic Paramedic. And so at this point in your life, you go off to college, something like being a paramedic is way off your radar screen.
Correct.
Not occurring to you. But once you got away and were at college, things started spiraling downhill. And so far in your story, everything looks fine. You've just been a success in high school, academically, athletically, socially.
Mm-hmm.
So how did this come about that you started spiraling down?
Well, due to the lack of support as a youth, essentially I just had kind of a chasm deep within me. A void, if you will, wanting to be accepted, wanting to feel safe, to feel loved, which I think most everybody can relate to.
Yeah.
And so then when I left home to go to this unknown place, college, I just essentially started feeling sorry for myself, frankly. And I used, you know, kind of the violence and abuse of my early life, plus the fact that I was, quote unquote, weird with these abilities, to self-sabotage. And so I decided, you know, I had been second in the state and, you know, a very decorated runner. And I started smoking, and then I started drinking, and then I started doing different drugs, and I quit the cross country team and very
well. You kind of sabotaged that too, because
I sabotaged
you didn't show up at practice, and the coach calls you in, and what happened?
Well, I was essentially at a point where I was just feeling kind of, you know, when you've been working with something for a long time, and then the energy or the stress, the pressure just finally comes to a head, and it just blows. Well, that's essentially what happened there, because I had just had my mom die and I'd faced 16, 17 years of daily violence and abuse and instability. So when they were wanting me to come to practice and I wanted to lay on the couch and watch TV, then they called me on it. I just exploded on them and essentially just quit. And it was arrogance. It was overwhelm. It was just, you know, I had just kind of hit my max with all of it. And that initiated the rapid spiral downward with the drugs.
Well, you had quite a life as a college student. You started going to a strip club.
I did.
And, I mean, you're very attractive, Sarah.
Why,
I could
thank
see
you.
I could see why a club would want you to strip for them.
Uh-huh.
But how did you get caught up in that?
Yes, what were you thinking?
What were you thinking,
what
Sarah?
Were you thinking? I wasn't actually new. That's
well,
pretty
you were young
much,
then. What, 18, 19?
Yeah, I just barely turned 18. And again, this is, I'm coming from a super violent and turbulent space. So I had no stability. I didn't, you know, and I was in a space of, like I said, kind of saying screw it to the world. I was just over it, you know. And we were late one night in a diner, and one of my best friends at the time, she just jokingly, because we were complaining we didn't have any money, and she just jokingly is like, oh, well, we could go be strippers. And I totally was like, yeah, let's do it. And they were like, no, we were joking. But for whatever reason, that just took hold in me. And I decided to do it. And so I started going down to Minneapolis on the weekends. And it was very overstimulating. And there was a lot that went along with that type of environment that I learned really quickly. Yeah.
So a real change of lifestyle from
Definitely.
This kind of somewhat innocent college girl to a stripper in a big city.
Yes, it was definitely an experience.
And like other things, you were successful at this endeavor also.
Yes. Well, initially, I mean, it's a very cutthroat industry. You know, it's not like there's no welcome committee to show you the ropes. You know, it's a very much like you go in and.
So the girls weren't saying, oh, welcome, Sarah.
No,
nice to meet you.
It's not like that. It can be like a really competitive kind of harsh environment. And obviously, it's a very sexually oriented and money oriented industry as well. Now, mind you, this was way back in the 90s. I have no idea what it's like anymore. But I would, you know, imagine it's roughly similar because we're working with different, you know, just vibrations and frequencies of things. And so when I got there, essentially, this was me being a bit arrogant and kind of throwing caution to the wind, and I don't care, and screw it, and I'm over life, and I'm just going to do whatever I want to do. And I started dancing topless and in this club, and I just essentially was able to, my experience with it was not just being in a club. My experience was working with the energies also in the club. So I could see kind of the root chakra energy of the men, the patrons, right, which is a sexual, like the first and second chakra, there's going to be a lot of sexual energy coming there and just different frequencies coming from the girls. And I could see where, and I could sense where they had felt, well, maybe violated, not in the club situation, but in their life, because I could see and feel the energy in their systems. And so it was like a multi-sensory experience for me, not just a dance and a lap dance.
Mm-hmm. Because you say when you first arrived on campus, when you went to college, you could see the energies of the college students and how they were, what their emotions were. You could read that. And then you go in this club and you see these dark energies of the patrons and the other girls. I want to talk to you more about this, and I want to hear you read from some of your books, because your book is set up so that you have flashbacks. You tell your life story leading up to your life as a paramedic, but then
Correct.
You also tell us, you describe situations that you found yourself in as a paramedic.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk to you about that. I'm
Wonderful.
Going to ask you about that when we get back.
Great.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is a paramedic. She has been in some of California's busiest 911 systems. She currently trains paramedics. Her name is Sarah Grace, and she has spent years studying physical and energy anatomy, which she uses as skills as a medical intuitive, a clairvoyant medium, and an energy healer to help clients in private practice. And I've been asking her about her memoir, Journey into Grace, Tales of a Psychic Paramedic. Mm-hmm. So the very introduction of your book, Sarah, is a scene where you are on duty as a paramedic. Mm-hmm. So I would like for you to read this section of your book. We get to see what it's like to go on a call. So would you read that?
Absolutely. My shift was almost over, and I was glad. It was 10:30 on a balmy Saturday night. My partner Kevin and I had spent 10 hours running 911 calls on people who didn't require anything close to emergency medical attention. There was the woman seeking narcotics for back pain, the homeless kid who just wanted a ride to the other side of town, and the little old lady who was confused and needed help changing her husband's diaper. We were both starving since we hadn't had a moment to stop and eat all day. When a break in the radio traffic finally came, we decided to seize the moment of blessed silence by grabbing some Mexican food, popping a comedy into Kevin's portable DVD player, and posting, which is a custom in the private ambulance business that entails sitting in a parking lot awaiting further assignment from dispatch. Neither one of us wanted to move another inch that night, so I kicked off my combat boots, rolled up a towel for a pillow, and used my navy blue jacket as a makeshift blanket. Curled up in a ball on the passenger seat, I was fully ready to satiate my appetite by inhaling my chicken burrito and being mindlessly entertained by Hollywood's latest for the duration of our shift. But fate had other plans. Only minutes after getting comfortable, our radio scanner crackled to life and dispatch assigned us to a motor vehicle accident just down the road. Kevin and I groaned in unison, snapped the DVD player shut, and threw the rest of our food in the trash before flipping on the lights and the sirens. Responding to this call would once again have me up close and personal with the beautiful energy and bloody splendor of death.
My guest is Sarah Grace, and she is just reading from her memoir, Journey into Grace, Tales of a Psychic Paramedic. So you're describing this call that you and Kevin are on, and Kevin is the guy you're working with, fellow paramedic. Now, was he a paramedic, he was an EMT?
EMT
okay,
partner.
So you were the senior member of this duo.
Correct.
So he's following what you're asking him to do.
Correct.
So off you go. You arrive at this scene, and you see there is has been an automobile accident.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of the things you were saying before that evening were not really that much of an emergency.
People Which is just, very standard for EMS. Most of it is not, I shouldn't say most, but a lot of it is not 911, not actually emergent.
Yeah, in fact, I hear some of the things that people call 911 for, mm-hmm. and you think, oh, please,
mm-hmm.
that's okay. something you could solve on your own.
Right.
So you see that there's this shattered glass everywhere, and you think, well, maybe it's not so bad, but then down from an embankment, you see that there's a Honda Civic that's been totally destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't even look like a car anymore, you write in your book. And the driver's side was crushed and crumpled. And your thought was, there's no way anybody alive is in there.
Mm-hmm.
But the police and firefighters were there. They're scrambling around, yelling at each other. And the fact that they weren't calm and collected made you think, okay, this is really serious. This is going to be bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so you and Kevin are going to help whoever this is in the car. And who did it turn out to be?
It turned out to be a very young woman who was driving, and she was making a left through a large intersection when she was T-boned at a high rate of speed, roughly 50 to 60 miles an hour, by a brand new Hummer H2. And the state that I found her in was she was unconscious and unresponsive in the vehicle, but still barely breathing.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, we find out a little later on, you say she was 18 at the time, but she was only a week away from her 19th birthday.
Yes.
So here's this young, beautiful young girl. And why don't you pick up reading there, Sarah?
Okay. Taylor, which was the patient's name, was staring straight ahead at the roof of the car while her delicate mouth gasped shallow, broken, guppy breaths. Bright red blood streamed from her forehead, and her skin was a pasty white from shock. Even in her current state, her youth and beauty struck me as I reached out to her with a bag valve mask to assist her breathing. Firefighters had secured the car but were still working on extrication, so I had to work on her body through the tiny opening of a shadowed back window. Holding her bloody head in my hands, I applied the cervical collar to her neck to immobilize her spine and then suctioned the blood from her mouth. Kevin was right behind me, handing me every tool I needed as I worked on inserting a breathing tube into Taylor's mouth. Her body had a weak pulse, but she wasn't breathing effectively, so we needed to control her respirations. Access was difficult, but we managed the best we could until I suddenly began to feel the presence of Taylor's soul moving away from her body. As plainly as the crushed car and broken body in front of me, I saw her sweet young spirit hovering 2 feet above and just to the right of us. A cord as thin as a spider's web ran from her spirit, from her physical form, connecting just below her breastbone. Wide-eyed and confused, her soul clearly couldn't register what was happening. Her spirit shook its head in disbelief as she watched me repeatedly squeeze the bag valve to pump air into her limp body.
Now, I want to pause just a second there, Sarah, because you're describing this. You say that you see her soul leave her body and hover just 2 feet above, and then there's this cord that's very thin, you say like a spider's web, mm-hmm. that ran from her spirit to her physical form. Mm-hmm. So what you're seeing is her soul has left the body, but it's still hovering nearby, and it is still connected.
It was tethered, yes, because there was still a heartbeat present.
Uh-huh. So and this must not have been the only time you saw something like this.
No, I saw hundreds and hundreds of episodes like this throughout the course of my career, if not thousands, but yes.
So you'd see the spirit leave the body, mm-hmm. and yet still stay tethered to it as long as there was a heartbeat.
Usually, yes. The heartbeat was kind of the common denominator for when I noticed that tether still present.
And so if the tether was lost, then you probably lost hope that you would be able to revive this person.
Well, and when I was looking at it from the higher perspective, you know, when we're looking at a trauma situation and the likelihood of somebody coming back from a CPR, just in the medical, you know, the way that we look at it in the medical, it's a very shallow possibility or slight possibility. And then when we're looking at it, when I was able to see the actual energy releasing from the physical vessel and then going out, then it was even more apparent to me how far into transition they were. And so I would kind of have like my own vantage point, if you will, mm-hmm. or my own intuitive knowing.
Extra information
about the patient's condition, correct.
And I might add, too, that you made it clear that that did not mean you stopped rescue operations. You still kept going with the CPR. You did everything you could, even after you saw that this was the end of this person's life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's protocols to uphold. And, of course, we want to do everything that we can for the family and, you know, loved ones involved.
And, of mm-hmm. course, nobody else around you can see what you're seeing.
Correct.
So they continue with everything they can do.
Correct.
To save
this
person's
life.
That's
our job. Yes, absolutely, as paramedics.
Yeah. And would you read some more of this particular episode?
Sure. Using the jaws of life, firefighters finally pulled the driver's side door off and began freeing Taylor from the wreckage. Just then, I saw a bright light appear behind her soul. It started like a few fireflies dancing together at dusk and then spread into a shimmering light of cobalt blue and white, coalescing into a massive celestial angel behind her spirit. At least 10 feet tall, the angel emanated a calm, soothing love, and its powerful presence expanded outwardly, blanketing the chaotic scene with a tranquil silence. Through my clairvoyant vision, I watched in reverent awe as Taylor's spirit turned away from the wreck and turned towards the angel, her face slowly softening into acceptance as the angel wrapped its arms around her. The two spirits began merging into one brilliant light just as the firefighters freed Taylor's legs from the wreckage. The pressure of the steering column had been keeping her circulatory system intact. Once removed, her blood pressure plummeted and her heart suddenly stopped beating. My hands never stopped working on her physical body, even though I knew what was coming. In one brilliant flash, an angel and beautiful young girl became a single source of light and disappeared altogether from my view. As suddenly as they were there, they were gone, taking the expanded energy of the scene with them.
This is Sarah Grace reading from her memoir, Journey into Grace, Tales of a Psychic Paramedic. Now, Taylor, in this paragraph you were just reading, you have this angel appear and put her arms around this young girl. And all of us reading this book would think, oh, that would be so nice. But Sarah, I just don't believe you.
You just don't believe me. Okay.
No, I'm saying that that's what I think people might be who are listening are saying. That mm-hmm. is just beyond what I'm able to believe.
Okay.
What can you answer to people who say, Sarah, that's just too hard for me to believe, that an angel comes, wraps their arms around you? Because that would be so nice. If I were in an automobile accident and I were dying, to think, oh, an angel is going to come put her arms around me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a really fair question. You know, I mean, we live in a real linear society that's very tangibly based, and anything outside of the normal quote-unquote perspective is met with skepticism, which is a healthy thing, I think. So then what I would ask is, you know, again, honoring the skepticism and then digging a little bit more deeply into why there's such resistance into believing that something is possible beyond the current set of reality or knowingness, right? And essentially, it's not always an angel. It could be loved ones, families. You know, if somebody's in transition, I often saw loved ones that had passed over. I saw many, many husbands and wives reunited. And so that was quite beautiful and quite undeniable, you know, as the person who was with me and the patient that was dying would start to sense the soul of their spouse that had potentially passed. And I could see the soul essence of the spouse. And so I would be having a conversation with the actual patient who was passing about the spouse being in the room. And that type of thing is real in the tangible, you know, connectedness. And so I honor skepticism. I was skeptic for a long time, like I said, and I think it's a healthy thing.
Well, in the case of Taylor, this young 18-year-old, almost 19-year-old, there was a further poignancy to the story in that there had been somebody waiting for her at a restaurant.
Mm, yeah.
And who was that?
That was harsh. So essentially we found out later, after she was pronounced dead in the hospital, that her boyfriend was waiting around the corner, and he was in a restaurant, and she was only two blocks away. And she was on the phone with him when she got hit, and come to find out he was going to propose to her that night. And that was really harsh for all of us that had witnessed and had worked that 911 call. That was the added information that was really painful.
And what you actually write in your book, that news felt like a kick to my gut. I needed a moment to compose myself. And you say you walked into the emergency room bathroom, and when you saw yourself in the mirror, you said, it looked even smaller than usual in my baggy blue uniform, because you are tiny. What are you, 5'1"?
5'1".
And you say that Taylor's blood, blotches of her blood were all over your jacket, and you had scrapes on your arms from pulling her out of the car. And there was even broken bits of broken glass buried in my curly hair. And you then go on to finish this chapter. So what was I supposed to do with all this? Read that section.
Mm-hmm. What was I supposed to do with all of this? How was I supposed to function every day while watching people's souls transition over and over again? Moreover, who would even believe me if I told them what I see? The same old fear and exhaustion that I'd been experiencing for as long as I could remember bubbled up from a deep space within. Since childhood, I had felt alienated by my abilities. EMS had finally provided me with fertile ground to use my gifts for good, but I still had no context or support for what I saw.
Yeah, so this is the way you conclude the introduction to your book.
Correct.
Describing what it's like to go on. And this probably is not that atypical of your experiences when you would go out on a call. You would have some variation of that more often than you would like, I'm sure.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. So this is the introduction to your book. You show us what it's like, your life as a paramedic,
mm-hmm.
and then you continue with your life as you were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And when we last were talking to you, Sarah, you were a stripper.
Yes. Off the rails. Yes.
And then at some point, though, you said, I was the one to pull myself out of it. Nobody could do it for me.
Yes.
This spiral that you had gotten yourself into. And you even listed six steps. Here's what I've got to do to turn my life around.
Right.
Do you remember what your first step was?
Vaguely. Well, essentially, again, just to reiterate, coming from the space of having no self-love and not feeling safe or as though I mattered, really, it lent me to going into self-destructive patterns. And I really went for it. And so in addition to stripping, I was doing a lot of smoking upwards of 3 packs of Marlboro Reds a day, which now I think about that, I'm like, oh, my God. A lot of coke and cocaine.
Cocaine,
and
yeah.
Ephedrine, which is, it used to be sold at the truck stops over the counter, but it's the main component of meth, which they obviously don't sell over the counter anymore. And so I was really in a state of internal chaos and real self-sabotage. You know, I was in a space, Nancy, where I just didn't feel like I wanted to live. Everything was dark. Everything for me was black, and I didn't feel connected or that I was worth anything. And in addition to having the stimulus forever of you know, being able to see people's energy and feel and know their thoughts and all of it, it just lent me to that downward spiral. And so essentially I hit a rock bottom when I had overdosed or apparently been slipped something, because I woke up in my car in the middle of Minnesota 2 days after the date I remembered, and I had no idea what had happened to me, and I was quite disheveled. And so that was kind of my rock bottom moment. And
you actually tried to commit suicide.
I did, yes. I went home from that experience, and that was, again, that culmination of all of that pressure and the energy and that sense of isolation, you know, and just worthlessness, honestly. And so I swallowed some Tylenol and I just laid down and I was like, this is it, you know? And so
I thought that was interesting too. You have access to all these other drugs you're taking, like cocaine, but you decide, okay, Tylenol is what I've got, so I'm just going to overdose on Tylenol.
Right. Well, I guess I didn't think about overdosing on cocaine, but yeah, it was just what came to me at the time. And essentially, you know, I took the pills and I laid down and I was just over it. I was complete with life, and I was really just severely depressed and in deep despair and just completely feeling isolated and, you know, and rock bottom, as I said. And so the visions that I saw in that space, though, because I went into a real tranquil awareness where I was essentially reminded of kind of my own capability, my own worth, and how what the life experience is, right? And kind of given a second chance, or I chose to come back and to call 911 and to go, which was actually my first, you know, interaction with a paramedic.
With 911.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Which wasn't necessarily a great experience. And it made me decide then, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm not going to be like that guy. He was just really jaded and closed down and kind of mean as a paramedic
that came to your rescue.
Mm-hmm. And that really landed with me. Like, I'm not going to be like that if I do this. So then essentially after I recoalesced from that, I went into a hospital for a psychiatric evaluation. And so essentially by my deepest fear came true, because that had been my core fear, was that I was mentally ill. There was something mentally wrong with me. And so here I was. I had manifested myself in this psychiatric facility. And it was just kind of, you know, it was almost like a, see, but like, prove it to me. And look at what I'm here, right? I am crazy, blah, blah, blah. And I was buying into the story, buying into the victimization, buying into like what I had been told about it. And essentially when I was in that space and I was looking at other people in there and who were actually very, very mentally unstable, full on, you know, then I was just like, no, this, I'm just depressed. I'm lost. You know?
These people need to be here, but I don't.
Right.
So I'm going to get myself.
I'm
going to
get
track.
Myself out of here, and I'm going to pull it together. And so that's really where I chose to shift. And it was very difficult for me to write all of that. It was excruciating. It's at a couple of points, I literally had my head on the table and I was like banging my head, because I was like, I don't want to put all of this. This is like, I feel embarrassed. And it's like, you know, oh my gosh, vulnerable is the word, right? To say, look, I messed up, and I messed up big. And here, let me just detail it for you. And so that was really challenging for me. But my intuition was like, no, put it all in, put it all in, put it all in. And essentially,
because at one point in your life, you did hold secrets. And that was not comfortable, like when you went off to college and you felt you were holding secrets.
Right.
So when you're writing this book, you didn't hold back.
No, it's just time. This was my birthing process, if you will. This was my coming to terms with the fullness of myself and my experience. And at the point after essentially the hospitalization, I came out and I was like, okay, if I'm going to change, I have to change. Nobody's going to do it for me. And I had a list of things, like really intense things that I needed to change in order to create a healthy life. And it was quit smoking, quit cocaine. Do you have the list there?
I do. I have the page open. Step one, because you had these steps that you were going to list.
Mm-hmm.
You said you are going to need all the encouragement you get. So you write down step one, start exercising. Because you used to run a lot. In fact, I was shocked how much running you did, Sarah.
Yes.
So you used to run a lot. So step one, start exercising. Step two, quit cocaine and ephedrine. Step three, quit drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Step four, stop smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Step five, eat better.
Mm-hmm.
And step six, figure out what I want to do with my life.
Yeah, just a little list.
But that's big.
That was so big.
And all the more impressive that you actually carried through with those things, those goals that you set for yourself.
Well, listen, after I hit rock bottom, I knew that I have nowhere to go. If I'm going to keep doing this, I'm going to die. And that's just how it was. I just knew that. And so essentially, it was kind of one of those moments in life where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, and you got to make the choice or the decision. Are we actually going to change? Are we actually going to do it? Or are we going to fall back into old patterns? And when I wrote it down, I find writing things down to be very helpful because then it becomes more concrete and absolute. I find it to be very important. When I listed them, you know, six major steps like that, I got totally overwhelmed, like I'm standing at the base of Everest. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm never going to be able to do this. But then I just calmed myself down. I was like, okay, just one step at a time. Just, you know, just take one at a time and then go a couple of weeks, you know, with each step. And ultimately, it took me quite a while, but 6 months roughly of really digging in and quitting everything cold turkey. I was able to pull myself through the worst of it and start to create a different life.
My guest is Sarah Grace. Her memoir is Journey into Grace, Tales of a Psychic Paramedic. Now, I mentioned that you're quite an attractive woman.
Well,
and
thank
is
you.
Not, but that's not just my opinion, because you were actually a Playboy model.
I was. Yeah. See, I tend to go for the extremes in life. Like, I can't just do a little something. I tend to go all the way for it. After I rehabilitated myself, I was still in really shaky grounds because I had felt disconnected from, like, the Midwest. I dropped out of college. I didn't want to be a stripper anymore. And I cut out a lot of my friends that I used to drug and party with. So I was kind of by myself and feeling like newborn. And I went on a trip to Florida with a friend. And through that, I ended up meeting a boy. And I ended up moving down there not that much longer. It was like a month later or whatever. And so I kind of rebirthed myself. I changed location, which I personally find to be helpful. When we're in a toxic state and we're around people that have known us to be one way, oftentimes it can be quite challenging. Because
so
even
you removed
if
yourself from
I
those influences.
I removed myself entirely from that situation and started over in Florida, kind of on this clean slate, like newly clean and, you know, getting back into the fitness and getting back into a semblance of safety for myself, if you will. But yeah, Playboy came to town and it was natural fit for me because I had been doing the topless dancing. So I was like, well, whatever, it's not a big deal. And this was back in the early 90s when Pamela Anderson, everybody was using Playboy to spring into Baywatch. And it was like a huge career launching thing. So there was a lot of glitz and glamour that came with it. And so I tried out and I was accepted.
So you had a career as a Playboy model.
I don't know if it was a career. We could say short stint.
Well, speaking of other short stints, something that I would never guess is that you were also a boxer.
Yes, and that was really fun. Essentially, I went through the modeling thing, and that was just really me, again, trying to find a sense of identity for myself. Because what I've found and what I've really reflected on through myself is that, like, when we aren't nourished as children, we oftentimes then go forth as adults overcompensating and trying to achieve or accumulate to fill that void of sense of self. And so my mind was initially a stripper, and then obviously I went into Playboy and into modeling and into movie casting, and I got into all the, like, you know, fancy Hollywood stuff, and that was cool. But then when we moved from Florida to Los Angeles, I wanted to start boxing. And it was great because I have, again, kind of falling back on my athletic background and, again, my propensity for extremes, because I did marathons and ultra marathons up to 50 miles, and I'd go running for hours and hours and hours by myself. Again, just remember, for me, it was like a taste of sanity, you know, a taste of groundedness, like calm, so that I could deal with the amount of stimulus that I was facing. And at the time that I was in, this was very late 90s, maybe 2000, that I moved to Hollywood, and I started going to this boxing gym. I had a lot of anger and a lot of, you know, because it was repressed from a lot of the things that I had done and experienced. And honestly, I was just really angry that, I mean, obviously about the violence of my youth, but even more so, I just wanted to be left alone from the energy stimulus. I mean, it was a daily thing to go to the store and to sense somebody's, what they're feeling, to hear their thoughts or to see their disease process in their body, or to just feel it's like this constant unwanted bombardment. And that can be maddening if you don't necessarily know what it is or how to work with it. So the exercise was my Prozac, my way of dealing with things. So getting into boxing, of course, this is old school Yellow Pages, right? Like, I pull out the Yellow Pages and I'm like, I just saw this ad. And so I call them up and I was, oh my God. I was like, so are you guys a real boxing gym or what? And they're like, are you like some Tai Bo? And they're like, no, we're a real boxing gym. So I go down there, and it turns out it's owned by a Hall of Fame boxing coach, and like all the elites train there, like Ali and Layla, all the way. I was like, oh, man. So I was just completely sticking out like a sore thumb, but it was wonderful because I had a great time.
So you have had such an amazing variety of occupations and careers, mm-hmm. but now you are still a licensed paramedic.
Correct.
You train paramedics, and you've been busy writing a book in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. So you now, though, make yourself available to people who want a little advice in their life and use your psychic abilities that way.
I do, yes. And so to kind of sum up, eventually I became a paramedic. I started in South Central and Compton and Inglewood, and then I moved up into the Bay Area and then again in Northern California.
So you're in the Sacramento area now.
Yes. And so I've been licensed for 15 years, and I was on the streets for roughly 13. Not on the streets anymore, but I am teaching at a national level, the national curriculum, which I will continue to do. That being said, I now have clients internationally, and a lot of the people are coming for help with their own intuitive and psychic abilities that they don't know how to work with, because, again, just the understanding of how to work with that is paramount. There's millions of us, Nancy.
And you've been there and done that.
Yes. There's so many of us. And, I do a lot of different things. It's fun.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Sarah, about your amazing life and about the life that you have now. And your book, again, for our listeners, Journey into Grace, Tales of a Psychic Paramedic, and the author is Sarah K. Grace. The 1078 Galleries Literary Committee invites you to engage with area authors at the first annual Local Authors Fair in Chico. This event takes place a week from tomorrow, Saturday, December 3rd, from 6 to 9 p.m. to showcase literary talent in the North State, as well as a chance to buy holiday gifts for your book-loving friends. The 1078 Gallery is located at 820 Broadway Street in Chico. Authors interested in purchasing booth space can stop in at the bookstore, 118 Main Street in Chico. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.